So that's the outside of Max Gate. It started life literally as a two up, two down. It was a much smaller house than you see it now. There was only one of the towers on it at that time. He built on this scale, really, I think, because he was a bit worried that at any moment the rug would be whipped from under him and he'd find himself back in his little cottage without two halfpennies to rub together. Never happened, of course, and was never likely to. He was a wealthy man when he built this house, but was always worried that I suppose many people come from humble backgrounds as he did, would be worried by the fact that having made all this money, he could just as easily lose it. And so he was very careful with his money. So it wasn't till 1895, after Jude the Obscure was published, to a cacophony of disapproval, that he gave up writing novels, decided, I think, that he probably had enough money to live on for the rest of his life, providing he was careful, and went on a great building spree at Maxgate. So he built the tower here on the right, with the sundial on it, and a huge amount out at the back, including a new, large, purpose-built study, which he could work in much more comfortably than the little box room that he'd started out in. Well, this was the middle lawn, and this was where Emma used to hold her garden parties. And over here, there are two points of interest. The little green door in the wall there, Hardy's escape route. If he saw someone coming up the drive he didn't wish to speak to, he used to grab the dog, come along the back of the hedge there and out through there, whilst the maid could go to the front door and say, "Mr. Hardy is not at home." Because he never liked lying to people directly, is he? And this we have here is called the Druid Stone, at least that's what Hardy called it. It's the remains of a Neolithic stone circle that once stood on this site. There are three stones left, two in this garden and one in the garden over the other side. I'm not sure whether this is apocryphal or not, but on one occasion I have been told that Hardy came out of the drawing room and saw smoke billowing from behind this stone, and when he went over to investigate, apparently found Emma behind it burning all his love letters to her, which he equated with the love letters of Robert Browning and Elizabeth Barrett. So whether this is true or not, I wouldn't like to say. And then down here you have the Alley of Bending Boughs. In one of Hardy's poems, he says, "Why do you make me leave the house and think for a breath it is you I see at the end of the alley of bending boughs where so often at dusk you used to be?" Okay, so we can walk down the alley of bending boughs. So if you get a shiver down your spine, you're walking through Emma's ghost. Did write a lot of poetry about ghosts and Emma's ghost hovering above him in the hall there, and imagined that she was sort of keeping an eye on him from a distance, but couldn't communicate. So he had this very frustrating feeling where she's sort of hovering above him trying to communicate, and he's there sort of musing away about how he thinks she might be up there trying to communicate. Her death was quite unfortunate in the sense that about 3 days before she died, she'd gone off to visit some friends in Puddletown and come back complaining of severe indigestion, plainly a heart problem. And she went up to her little attic room at the top of the house on the other side there, and took to her bed for a couple of days. On the third day, two American ladies were coming to visit, with whom she corresponded over many years. And they actually insisted on her coming down to see them, and she wasn't really well enough. Hardy had said she should stay in bed. And she's plainly unwell during the tea she had with them, and she went back up to her little room. And the following morning, when Dolly Gale, her maid, went in to help her get dressed, she found her literally at her last gasp. She was gasping for Hardy, her husband, and Dolly, who was only 14, was quite alarmed by this, obviously, and went scuttling down the stairs, knocked on the study door, was admitted, and said to Hardy that the missus has been taken bad, sir, I think you ought to go up and see her. And according to her, Hardy looked her up and down, told her to straighten her collar, and dismissed her. And half an hour later, he went up to see Emma, by which time, of course, she'd lapsed into a coma from which she'd never recovered consciousness. Of course, that was bad enough, the fact that he hadn't actually seen her to speak to her before she went unconscious. She died shortly afterwards. But even worse was the fact that she left a little time bomb behind her, which he didn't discover until after the funeral, in the form of a series of diaries and notebooks that she kept, some of which were apparently entitled What I Think of My Husband, which of course was not a lot. And I think they brought him face to face with her perception of how he treated her all those years, and it sent him into this great paranoia, really. Paranoia, perhaps, but a great feeling of guilt at the way he treated her. And he went on to write some of the most beautiful love poetry in the whole of the language to this woman who didn't know he felt like that and who was no longer allowed to enjoy them. Of course, the second wife, who knew what a poor relationship they'd had, thought that once they were married everything would be hunky-dory, but of course found herself typing out the love poetry to the first wife to send to the publishers, so neither wife got much of a deal out of T.H., I'm afraid, but then he was a writer, and that was what he did. Seems to be the way they operate. So this is the dining room, and this is the room we keep all the Hardy furniture that we have in, or nearly all of it. It was all sent down to the museum. Hardy had actually earmarked the pieces that he wanted to go to the museum. And so the museum have just set up a new writer's gallery. Didn't really have space for the furniture, so very kindly loaned it back to us. So we have it back. That is our latest acquisition, sofa, sort of Egyptian influence sofa, which is quite interesting. Hardy always uses things in his work, and it's interesting that he is supposed to have had an affair with his cousin Tryphena Sparks when he was about 26 and she was 16, and years and years later she went off and married someone else and lived in Topsham for many years, and then years and years later Hardy was going up to London and had a premonition that she died, and he just composed a couple of lines of poetry in his head, never a hair of her head of eye or something like that. It was called Thoughts of Fina on her death. When he got back, he discovered that she had died.
Wow.
And to illustrate the poem, he actually did a drawing of Tryphena lying on this sofa in 1898 for Wessex Poems. You can see the sofa is exactly the one that she's lying on. You can see she's got her maiden form bra on. Two bookcase things, which I always thought were sort of do-it-yourself as delight. T. Lawrence mentions in his diaries as being the two movable bookcases on either side of the fireplace, and how they're stuffed with books. There are piles of books all around the perimeter of this room. So I guess Hardy got an unsolicited copy of everybody's book in the hope that the great man would read it and comment favourably. Instead, he tended to just write them a quick note saying, "Thank you for your kind gift, I shall have great pleasure in reading it," and it probably joined the pile of books around this room. So, but at least they got his autograph. This was the bedroom, Hardy's bedroom. It was also his first study, in which he wrote The Woodlanders. And but this is the room also that he died in. Yeah. Interestingly, he'd lost his religious faith quite early on, and right at the end he has the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam read to him rather than the Bible. The rose blows along the river brink with old Khayyam the ruby vintage drink. When the angel with his darker draft appears, take that and do not shrink, which Hardy did. This was the original kitchen to the house before it was extended. Had an outside door. After that, it became the bicycle room. Hardy used to keep his bike in here. So It had an exit to the outside. Now somebody, the only part of the house that's been built since Hardy's day was the little thing there, which was a bathroom for a little old lady who sort of lived in here. And things like this we discovered, it was hidden inside a, well, beautifully boxed in, and nobody knew it was there. It's a kitchen range. So the previous tenants, when I asked them what was in the box, said, oh, it was just some mucky old boiler and rusty old iron pipes. I suppose it was, really. And it had a rather nasty four mica top on it, so I thought, well, I'll get rid of that and put a nice wooden one on. So I had a couple of National Trust carpenters in at the time, and one of them had a jemmy, so we sort of jemmied one of these boards up, and there was this. So I sort of stripped it all out. We now use it with groups of children who do sort of Victorian houses, or if it's very cold or we do cooking for masses of people, we put that on. Well, this originally had a well. The original well that was built was dug rather. It was on this bit here, and there was a stone sink here, and a pump. And apparently when they first started digging the well and the foundations, the first thing they came across was human remains, which Hardy used to call skeletons, which he declared were Roman soldiers to start with. And then when he'd done a bit more experimentation, he's quite an amateur archaeologist, he discovered in fact it was a Romano-British cemetery dating back to about AD 400. And some of the finds that he made in the graves are actually in the museum in Dorchester. Yeah, he was a very interesting man. And he was a man who could turn his hand to anything, and was a great self-educator. What he didn't know, he taught himself, and quite assiduously. I say 100 years ahead of his time, basically, and that got him into a lot of trouble with his novels as to their morality, really. And what he was trying to do was to show how all these Victorian iniquities impinged on the little people. Things like divorce, like not being able to get divorced, and sex education, all that sort of thing. He was an advocate of. So in fact, Mary Stopes was a frequent visitor to Maxgate in the 20s. So he was quite interested in her work. Locally, he was not popular. Locally, people regarded him as mean and standoffish to a large extent. But it was, thank you, Henry, partly an innate shyness, I think. Partly because he came from the class that servants normally came from, and I think he had some difficulty in sort of relating to servants and things like that. So the servants often give him a bad press. On the other hand, his contemporaries, the people who knew him well, speak of him very highly. He was a kind, generous man who, if he wasn't going to spend his money on you, would certainly spend time. And so, particularly in the 20s, he took a number of young authors under his wing, people like Siegfried Sassoon, a poet, T. Lawrence. Was a frequent visitor to Maxgate, a great favourite of Hardy's, and was really very generous with his time and his experience, and very helpful to a lot of people. As I say, locally he had problems, but I think on the whole he was a kind man with a sense of humour. Locals will tell you he had no sense of humour. I don't think that's true. His sense of humour comes through in his novels and some amazing poems. And yes, he's. I think he was quite a pleasant person, but shy, and not one to push himself forward. A lot of people would say, you know, if Hardy was at the table, you wouldn't hear very much from him. He was very unprepossessing in that way. He didn't push himself forward at all, but. A kind person, I think, and certainly concerned about the issues of the day. And he, in his novels, as I say, he's trying to sort of show how these things impinge on people who have no power. And he expresses his opinions through his novels in that sense, very rarely and directly. Was the tenant of Max Gate, yes, I think it's a wonderful house to live in. It has such a bad press, it's actually a very easy house to live in. It's everything's to hand, and it's large, but not so large as that you get lost in it. And yeah, it's just the most delightful house to live in.